The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Faster my good afternoon. Welcome to Man in Line on Manx Radio. Mad housing today. David Ashford, MHK, has been an MHK for, well, quite a while now. And most recently, in fact, last October, was appointed a member of the Cabinet Office and chair of the Housing and Communities Board. Now, housing policy, a central strategic importance for the future of the Isle of Man, Mr. Ashford said, and he looks forward to using his previous political experience to deliver better housing outcomes for our community. So what do you think? Pastor Mike, good afternoon, David Ashford.
Good afternoon, Andy.
You said recently you've been quoted about the what's the name of this famous report?
The OHAN. It's the assessment of housing needs.
And you say it doesn't need to stay on the shelf. Something needs to happen, basically.
It does indeed. I mean, this cannot be a report that just everyone says thank you very much for it being produced and then it goes off into a dusty drawer somewhere. This actually shows what we need to do if we are going to have economic growth in the island. I said when I took up this job, and you just quoted part of it there in October, that if government is going to achieve its island plan ambitions, if we are going to achieve the economic strategy that we have laid out, then we are going to have to deliver on housing, because housing is integral to that.
So you think everything kind of it's like a fulcrum, everything rests on housing. If we get housing wrong, it's not going to happen.
It does, because we will not attract young people back to the island. We will not keep the young people that we've currently got here, and we certainly won't attract young families to the island, and that is the island's future. So housing has to be done, and it has to be done right.
What are the issues? What are the obstacles currently in the way?
So a lot of the big problems I get, because of course I get it as a constituency MHK as well, is people accessing housing, first time buyers. There's people, a lot of people that feel that the schemes aren't currently right, and there is a review of the schemes underway. There's people who feel that the mix of schemes that are available, so for some shared equity, others midpoint rent, others wanting maybe plot to build, isn't quite right at the moment. And also the private rental market, because that's the bit that always gets forgotten about, because we keep focusing on first-time buyers and people owning homes, but there will always be an element of people that will need rental property. And there is, at the moment, a problem I'm getting very clearly from people, that they are having problems accessing affordable rental property.
We had quite a call yesterday from a gentleman called Neil, who put some points he wants me to put to you today, and that is that he thinks the private rental market is skewed, basically. It's skewed towards the people who own the majority of the properties, and that it is harming, if you like, social cohesion on the island.
Well, one of the things we need to do, and I'm particularly in favour of with private rental, is we need to have a broad mix. So in terms of private rental, there needs to be more social housing. That comes out very clear in the OHAN report, that we need to be building the social housing stock in terms of the public sector. There's also, we also need to ensure that we bring new landlords into the market. And I think at the moment, because of the current situation with inflation, the current situation particularly with interest rates as well, and buy-to-let mortgages, that's discouraging new landlords from coming into the market. But we do need to have it so that the private rental market is a very broad church, so to speak, with multiple landlords rather than relying on maybe a few big landlords.
And this is what was mentioned yesterday, in that there are, I mean, first of all, being a landlord, private landlord, is absolutely fine. It's not illegal. It's very honourable in many places. Lots of people have private landlords who are the best friends, and they look after the properties very well and have a good relationship. There are, of course, other landlords who exist purely to make money out of it, and some of them operate for the DHSC, and the problem is that that seems to be causing a problem.
And that is why it's important that the regulation around housing is right. The Act, of course, came in the last administration trying to deal with this issue. The regulations have still to come forward. And I think it is important that those regulations come forward as soon as possible, both so landlords know what the obligations on them are, and that then ensures that they've got certainty, but also it makes sure that we've got a proper regulated private sector rental market.
What's to stop a public authority or indeed the government to announce soon that we're going to build a new social housing estate, that something is going to be done?
Well, this is something I said in an interview, funnily enough, with Manx Radio. I lose track of time this week, but it's either yesterday or the day before, where I actually said that that is something that should need to move forward now quite quickly. And it's something, certainly as Chair of the Housing Communities Board, I will be pushing for, because in terms of public sector housing, that is within government's gift. We've got the Housing Association work going on at the moment. We have already public sector housing providers around the island in the forms of the local authorities and several other housing boards, and we need to start engaging with them as a government to say, right, this is what the OHAN says we need, this is where our target needs to be over the next few years, you know, how can we assist you and how can you assist us in ensuring we deliver those targets? And it needs to be collaborative. I need to make that absolutely clear. From my personal point of view, it has to be collaborative with the housing department, with the housing authorities around the island, not government dictating to them or the housing authorities saying we'll go off and do our own thing. We need to work together to ensure that we can deliver for the island as a whole.
Is there an appetite within those housing authorities to start something like this?
I think certainly a couple that I've spoken to, there most certainly is. I know Douglas is very, very keen to engage with government. I've had meetings with Douglas. I've had chats with Douglas around it. Douglas has come up with a actual plan for their housing going forward into the future, which is a very ambitious plan. And I think one of the key things we've got to remember when we talk about housing as well, and this is the important thing that we need to get right, is it does cost money. There needs to be investment. It's not something you can do without investment. And that's always the black cloud hanging over anything, as we know, in this day and age. And if we are serious about housing, we've got to be upfront and say it is going to cost and it is going to require upfront investment.
Douglas made a fine job of those pristine new flats on Peel Road. I mean, you would need many more of those, would you?
So what we've got, and that's a very good point, Andy, because what's important as well is the housing mix. So although maybe the modern thing is flats, there is also, of course, big demand for family houses as well as we move forward. And both in private sector rental, first-time buyers, ordinary dwellings just being sold on the open market, what we need to ensure, and that's why this report is so important, is that we get that mix right. Because if we are attracting the demographics that we want to attract in order to deliver on the economic strategy, then that means we've got to have the right housing mix. There's no point having a load of one-bed flats that might not actually work for the people we're wanting to attract into the island or even retain on the island.
Where does the Manx Development Corporation fit into all this?
So the Manx Development Corporation will also have a key role because, of course, at the moment they're looking at the brownfield sites, in particular government sites. And if people have followed what I've been saying in Tynwald for a while, one of my big frustrations has always been government sites left vacant. I recently asked a question of the Minister for Health about what's happening with Retina Bay, because I was a bit concerned that was going to be yet another one in Douglas, that when they move up to Summerhill View was just going to be left empty. The minister's reassured me there's stuff going on in the background. But you've got the Park Road site that is still vacant, not developed. There were plans for that back in 2012, the year I was mayor of Douglas.
What were the plans?
From memory, I went to a wonderful presentation. So that was 12 years ago now as mayor, and it was to have some first-time buyers. There was going to be some ordinary houses on the open market. There was going to be some sheltered housing as well. It was going to be a real mix round a sort of squared area on that site with a square in the middle, communal square.
It's a huge site.
It is a massive site, and they were really, really good plans from my point of view, but unfortunately yet again they were plans that seemed to have gone off somewhere, never to be realised. And this is the thing that frustrates me when it comes to sites. You've got the Victoria Road prison site. When government is vacating sites, and these things don't just vacate suddenly, they're years in the planning normally, the prison was, Park Road was, you know, we need to be thinking at the same time what's going to happen afterwards, not worrying about it once it's happened.
There's a message in from 212, texter 212. In some Scandinavian countries, social housing is scattered throughout all other housing. For example, there won't be an individual block of apartments that's social housing. Instead, there'll be an apartment block full of private individuals where a few of the apartments happen to be social housing. Is that a better model to adopt rather than isolating all of social housing into discrete areas?
I mean, it's a model that you do see in the UK as well, because, of course, they have the ability for people to purchase social housing, so it creates mixed estates. I think one of the problems there is when you have split landlords, it does cause problems with maintenance of the building, and you can have maintenance issues. So I know from speaking to political colleagues in the UK at a local government level, where you have, for instance, council-owned properties next to private dwellings, if there's an issue with the private dwelling affecting the public housing, it takes a bit longer to actually be able to resolve than if they owned the whole block of them. And maintaining an estate can sometimes be easier than doing bits here and bits there. But it's certainly, I think, every model needs to be looked at. And the Scandinavian models in various different things, not just that model, but some of the other things they do in Scandinavian countries, certainly need to be considered.
WhatsApper 153, and we've had this one before, but it bears repetition. Can't the old housing stock be offered for sale to current tenants to make the government income and put the income forward to build new houses?
Now, it sounds great in theory, but I've got to be honest, that is something I've never really favoured. As someone who spent 8.5 years at a local authority level as well, and quite a few of those years as chair of the Housing Committee on Douglas Council, my big worry is what you end up with is not necessarily the same level of social housing as you had before. Because as prices go up, you get less bang for your money. You don't necessarily end up building the same amount of social housing. We only have to look what's happened in the UK, where in many areas the amount of social housing has gone massively down. And also, you've got to make sure that you've got social housing in places where people want to live. And you are potentially, if you're selling stock, particularly in Douglas, you're moving the people in social housing further and further out of town, because there is only so many brownfield sites that can be redeveloped, even if you used all the brownfield sites for social housing. So I must confess I have never personally seen the actual advantage in terms of, you know, people being able to purchase the social housing. I think what the UK lesson, certainly from my point of view, has proven is that just depletes the stock.
Sheila in Douglas says there's a group of, I think it's social housing, the corner of Westmoreland Road and Circular Road. She said that's a big site. I mean, would that be possible? Wouldn't it be possible to knock those down, basically, and build something bigger there?
It's also, as far as I'm aware, the first actual public housing on the Isle of Man was that site on the Westmoreland Circular.
Is that so?
My understanding is it's certainly exceptionally old anyway. It's older than most, than any of the other real stock. I think it's at least 1919 odd that it was done, and it was when it was the Douglas slum areas were being cleared. But I think, I mean, that would be something that you could do, but they do serve a purpose, those ones. They are large houses, so most of them are 4 or even 5 bed houses, there's very few within the stock of Douglas that are 4 or 5 bed. But it is a large site, maybe it could be, but again, I'm not wanting to step on any local authorities' toes. And that would be a matter for Douglas Council to work with government if they wish to redevelop that site. It's not for me or government to be dictating what they should do with their stock.
OK, we'll get to the lines in a moment. First of all, Dave said, David, why can't government mortgages be reinstated at a reasonable rate that's affordable and produces a return that's palatable to the taxpayer?
Well, I think in this day and age, one of the things about mortgages and is an element of government support. One of the things I've always wanted to have looked at is whether you could have government-backed guarantee mortgages. I would worry about, in this modern age, government becoming a mortgage broker in its own right, because there are potentially substantial financial downsides and financial risks with that, with a lot of investment needed to actually keep it. But I think engagement with the banks on some form of government-backed guarantee is certainly one of the option mixes that I think needs to be looked at.
Is there an appetite within Treasury, within government, for this?
Well, that is the question. You know, I've got my own personal views, but it's not me that ultimately
like
presses
them,
the button. I think I just have, Andy. Yeah. I think it's something that should be looked at about government guarantees, and it needs to form part of the housing mix. And I think this is the key thing, and it's the key point for me, is it this: when it comes to housing, one size doesn't fit all. There are different types of schemes that will suit different people and what they're trying to achieve in terms of their housing ambitions. And that's why it's important we have a mixed selection of schemes for people to pick from, rather than trying to force people down one track.
Okay, David Ashford, MHK, is chair of the Housing and Communities Board, and we're talking in part about this report, the Objective Assessment of Housing Need Report, which has just been published. And really, getting housing right for the Isle of Man, the government's project, if you like, the Island Plan, is to get 15,000 more people on the Isle of Man, get us up to 100,000. And the question a lot of people ask is, where are they going to live? And Julian's on now. Hi, Julian. You're live with David Ashford, MHK.
Hi, Andy, and hello, David.
Julian.
Hiya. I've got two questions, but I think they're kind of related towards housing, population changes and influx. David, you're also the chair of the Assisted Dying Committee as well, aren't you?
Well, I was. The committee's no longer in existence because it's reported, so it has wound up now. But yes, I was chair of that.
Yeah, this does have kind of a bearing on the housing and everything else. Following a conversation I had with Andy last week about this, I noticed that on the Dignity and Dying website, the average cost of a person going to Dignitas has doubled since 2017 to £10,000 up to £15,000. So that leaves the vast majority of money going to Dignitas with a bit for flights because EasyJet goes to Zurich. I'm just wondering, apart from the fact that we might have an influx of population coming here that will be seeking this if this goes through, how much do you think the assisted dying legislation will cost Isle of Man taxpayers based on Dignitas charging £10,000 a head?
Right, so the first thing to actually point out is I wouldn't expect that we would see an influx, and the reason being that one of the amendments that has been made to the legislation, which carried my full support, was changing the residency criteria to the 5 years. So someone would have to have been resident on the island and meet the residency criteria for 5 years before they'd be able to access the provisions of the Act. If it had remained at the 12 months, that was a concern of mine, that you would have people potentially, once they've been diagnosed, if they were diagnosed with over 12 months, potentially deciding to move to the island, put pressure on the health service in order to potentially avail themselves of the Act later on. But with the amendment, that draws it out much further. In terms of the actual cost to the health service, I will be absolutely honest and say, as far as I'm aware, there's been no calculation done. But in terms of Dignitas, of course, Dignitas is operating, although it's got some charitable elements, it is operating as a business. There will be the cost of the drugs and obviously the cost in time to the consultants or doctors that are involved and medical professionals that are involved in this, but it won't be in the same way as the setup that Dignitas has had to create and actually provide, because one of the key components of the Act is for it to be provided in people's own homes. So you wouldn't require, a bit like Dignitas does, the centre and everything else and the running costs that go with that.
Okay, Julian?
Yeah, this brings me on to the shift in the population things. I mean, we're looking at the moment, as far as the World Bank says, that there are 11 deaths per 1,000 on the island, so that's about 900 odd. So made in Canada is 10% of all deaths are now with that. So you could say there'd be 90 people a year at least could be looking at this. So at 10,000 a head, if that's what it costs, that could be a million a year for the taxpayer to pay for assisted dying on the island. But I also noticed the government, Paul Crane did a report in 2020 saying that the birth rate has dropped from 1,000 a year in 2010 to 660. So if you've got over 900 a year anyway, as the death rate is at the moment, you've got about 260, 270 people less a year on the island. And Andy, you've been interviewing quite a lot of the students at most of the schools, and an awful lot of them are saying there's nothing here for them, and they're leaving, which kind of makes me wonder, is this part of the push to bring people over here? And I did mention to you yesterday, Andy, I'd heard that there was some sort of a government incentive of £422 per person per month for migrants and asylum seekers. I just wondered, David, is there any truth to that £400 being given to landlords to bring migrants into accommodation here? And also, what is the drivers for wanting this 15,000 on the island?
Yeah, firstly, in terms of the migrants one, as far as I'm concerned, there's no truth in it. I'm certainly not aware of anything that's being done in that regard. In terms of the assisted dying, again, just to go back, you mentioned Canada there, Julian. What we are proposing here on Ireland, what's come forward in the form of Alex Allenson's private members bill, is very different to what is available in Canada. Canada's access is much more wide-ranging than ours, so ours is severely limited in terms that if the bill as it stands is what becomes law, then basically only those with a diagnosis of 12 months or more, 12 months or less, will be able to actually, of a terminal disease, will be able to access. So it will be limited to that. It won't be as widespread as Canada is, where there's certain other conditions and so on that you can actually access theirs. So we wouldn't expect to be seeing the numbers anywhere near. In terms of the cost, like I say, the costs in our terms would be the dispensing of the drugs and the consultant's time. We wouldn't be running a centre like Dignitas, so I'd be exceptionally surprised if it had cost £10,000 a time per person, because I can't see how that £10,000 would be made up with the process that's in the bill. In terms of the birth and death rate, if you go back to the 1960s, in terms of births and deaths, Paul Crane did indeed mention about the 1,000 odd a year. That is actually, over the island's period since 1960, a bit of a blip actually, because between 2001 and 2014 the population, the difference between births and deaths was growing, and you actually had births that peaked at around about 1,000 a year in 2011, I think it was, but then it's dipped down again. So it's now, the last most recent figures I've seen was about 600 births a year, and we're negative, which has been the case for most of the time since 1960, between births and deaths. So it is quite important to the island that people are coming in. And the fact that we have a negative between births and deaths, but the population is still growing, shows that we are attracting people in, but not potentially in the quantities that we need to deliver on the economic strategy.
OK. All right. Thanks, Julian.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Good to hear from you. Well, here is a short question, but very big implications, and it's one that many people are talking about on the Isle of Man. Are we ever going to end urban sprawl? Underneath that, are we going to preserve what lots of people absolutely adore about the Isle of Man?
I think we are exceptionally lucky as an island. We take it for granted. I must confess, I was born on the island, other than after university when I briefly lived and worked in the UK. I've been here my whole life. And I think we take for granted the beautiful countryside, the mountains, everything else that we see, because we see it on a daily basis. We've got an influx of visitors coming over these next 2 weeks to enjoy our island. And the thing I always get from speaking to visitors is they're like, this is beautiful, this is gorgeous, particularly if the sun's shining. And what we need to do is we need to get that balance. We are lucky that we're not like Jersey and Guernsey, where we've got very, very much urban sprawl in a very compacted area. In terms of the percentage of the island that's actually built on, we are quite low compared to most countries, and we need to ensure that any building that we do is sensitive to that, to maintaining what we actually have. So certainly I wouldn't be in favour of what would be termed widespread urban sprawl. But it is important as well that we do continue to build, we do continue to provide homes for people, and we continue to grow the economy. But that has to be done hand in glove with maintaining the beautiful countryside that we have.
It's worth pointing out that Jersey, I think we are 13 times bigger than Jersey. They've got 100,000 people. We'd have to have 1 million people on the Isle of Man to have the same population density as Jersey.
We would. And I mean, a lot of Jersey, of course, particularly around the capital, St Helier, is flat as well, rather than actually houses, whereas one of the things that, of course, we are very keen on is ensuring that families can actually have actual house space.
Okay, and it's Eddie with us now. Hi, Eddie, you're live with David Ash for MHK.
Hi, Andy, David.
Hi, Eddie.
I've got 3 points, but just before I do, I was listening to Neil yesterday. He put up a lovely good show, good talk about so many different points. Just to say, I've got a little experience here. My daughter went away to university. While she was away at university, she used to come back as often as she could. But it's quite expensive to do that. The other thing is that while you're away at university, usually for 2, 3, 4 years, you actually experience where there is so much more to do on the mainland, which she loves music, she loves everything that's going out there, and that is an incentive to stay on its own. And the point is, once she had finished, when you start adding things up, that if I want to still go over it, you make a lot of friends while you're there at university, so you want to not just come back to work, but you're going to nip away to see your friends and so on. And it's the price of the steam packet that comes into that equation. There is no incentive for either the students to come back once they've added up how much it's going to cost to keep flitting there and back, or even the Manx people themselves, actually. I mean, my daughter could only afford, even now, once a year to come back to the Isle of Man, which she does every year. She's got family here. So to get to the main 3 points I was talking about, one is, I think last year the steam packet made about £15 million. Does that figure sound right?
It would off the top of my head, yeah.
Yeah, well, if instead of just keeping hold of that 15 million, why not say let's put 75% of it towards reduction of fares and then keep 25% as profit? Now, that in itself could bring fares down for those people who have just mentioned, people who are away, who are Manx-born and are at university, or Manx people themselves wanting to nip over for a day trip, shopping, so on. The other points are, we don't have the entertainment here like across. So surely we've got plenty and plenty, plenty of entrepreneurs who can, instead of wanting massive profits, just try running things. Entrepreneurs are meant to test the ground first with things, and then if it snowballs, they get the benefit. You know, which leads me on to the housing side. I was watching a program on television last night. If you, say, for instance, have these houses and people are buying them up just to let, why not bring in some sort of a legislation that says if you want to buy one of these houses from now on, you've got to live in it for 5 years, right? And that will, in turn, stop the speculation on that type, because it is greediness, really, because some of these people are asking absolutely astronomical fees for it. And the other thing is, for any first-time buyers, why don't the government give the kids and the young people the incentive by a very low mortgage? If they've got guarantee of they are born in the Isle of Man, they've got family on the Isle of Man, and everything in their work on the Isle of Man, then surely that's enough guarantee, should I say, for them to get a low mortgage.
Okay, well, let's put those to David Ashford.
So there's quite a few points in there, Eddie. Forgive me if I miss anything. In terms of access to the island and travel, yes, particularly for university students. I mean, I remember it was quite a few years ago now since I was at university, but the challenge was still the same then. And I was someone, as I just relayed before, who after university stayed in the UK and then came back to the island later. So I've done that myself. And, you know, one of the key things that came out of the economic strategy was around hospitality, and that if we are going to attract young people back to the island after university, if we are going to attract the young families in, we've got to have a vibrant hospitality sector. That is one of the reasons I've been asking the questions in Tynwald around what support's going to be in place for hospitality, because the sector has been struggling with what's here already. And if we're going to meet the economic ambitions, we have to grow that sector. It has to get better better, it has to get bigger. And at the moment, they're struggling with what's there, so they do need support. In terms of mortgages for young people, as I alluded to at the start of this conversation with Andy, I think that, you know, there is room for government to be looking to see what they can do in terms of guarantee. The problem with low mortgages, of course, is ultimately, unless we were stumping up the mortgages ourselves as taxpayers' money, you've got to go through the banks, and the banks have to clear a certain amount. There is the interest rates, which have been a serious problem recently, and mortgages will always fluctuate with interest rates, because if you didn't, then, and you use taxpayers' money for it, then you'd be getting less return than you would otherwise. So there is, it's a mixed bag, but I think there is things in that that you need, that can be looked at and do actually have merit. But certainly it is a struggle for young people to get back to the island, and we need to make it easier for them to do so. But the crucial thing is, we need to make them want to do so. And the only way they'll actually want to do so is if we have got a vibrant economy, a vibrant hospitality sector. And that, as I said, again, alongside housing, does mean upfront investment. And we have to be honest about that. It costs money. And in terms of the fares and so on, I'm going to say now exactly what I was, funnily enough, talking to someone about the other day. When the steam packet was first purchased by government back in, I think it was either 2018 or 2019, so it's been 5 or 6 years now, the plan, as far as I was always concerned, was that you would let the company bed in to make sure that it was operating as it should. And then as shareholder, the shareholder would be looking to what we could do around fares and everything else. That second half doesn't seem to have happened, as far as I can see. So I will be asking some questions around that when Timbledon Quays resumes after TT, because the personal view, and it is only my personal view again, but my personal view has always been the fares should be set fares across the year. It shouldn't matter whether it's TT, Christmas, anything else. If someone's travelling as a foot passenger, if someone's travelling with a car, they should know what it costs, and the fares should be competitive compared to other ferries elsewhere.
Okay, all right. Thanks, Eddie. We've got to crack on because we've got lots of questions, including Bill, who said, could you ask David Ashford why Lord Street flats can't be developed to sell or rent to first-time buyers? Excellent location, solid build. It's just empty at the moment. Why is it empty with no plan?
So Lord Street most definitely was a solid build. That was one of the areas I used to represent when I was a Douglas councillor, actually. So I know that area very well. But there is serious issues with it. I don't think it could be redeveloped, to be honest. Bear in mind, I've been in now 8 years. I was a Douglas councillor for 8.5 years before that, so we're going back 16 and a half years I've been around Manx politics, and Lord Street was in quite a state then. There was damp coming through all the walls. If I remember rightly, there's no cavities in those walls. They
is
were the
both,
proper
both
old...
sides of Lord Street?
It was both. So the side that is over on Quine's Corner, which is still occupied, yeah. That was never as bad. There were issues there, but there was never as bad as the main block running down Lord Street, which is what I assume that's being referred to, because that's the ones that are vacant. The Quine's yeah. Corner is still occupied. But in terms of the vacancy, you know, I think something does need to happen. I know that there was conversations with Manx Development Corporation about whether they could assist and help Douglas Council in some regard with those. It is a difficult site to develop because, of course, it's built up all around, and potentially with health and safety and everything yeah. else, both taking down and erecting, you might have to close Lord Street.
And there's a big car park.
And you've got the car park at the back, so yeah. you can't develop really from the back.
Yeah.
Of course, when they were originally built, none of that was all there. It was all a very different environment.
So is this down to Douglas Council?
So no, I think it's a partnership, to be honest. I think Douglas Council, to be fair, has been looking across their whole housing stock. I talked about their long-term strategic plan, which is a very ambitious plan. Douglas certainly, I know from talking to them, they don't want any properties to be vacant. They want to have things turned around and developed. But it is a difficult site to develop, that one, but it is one that longer term needs to be looked at, and I think Manx Development Corporation could assist in that regard.
We're with David Ashford, MHK, talking about housing on the Isle of Man. After Man in Line today, it's Friday, so we're back in the 60th anniversary archive with the great Chris Price, the late great Chris Price, talking to spectators at Craigneish in 1996 when there was a royal visit from the then Prince of Wales, of course now King Charles, as after Man in Line today.
With unlimited broadband from Shaw from £39.50 a month, you'll be laughing.
Shaw Fibre Broadband. It's the lowest price on island. For more details, see us in store or visit shaw.com. T's and C's apply.
Sometimes you need to roll out an extra bed. Millichaps have a wide range of affordable and superior single and double folder beds to suit all budgets, including luxury pocket sprung options and a fabulous choice of sofa beds in a variety of styles and sizes. Perfect for home offices and spare rooms, and all in stock for speedy delivery when guests are expected. And don't forget the pillows and bedding, with plenty of choice available at Millichaps. For fold-up beds and more, visit Millichaps today.
When you save a little money, it means a lot these days.
If you're looking for bathrooms and tiles, you'll always find something new in store at Pacesetter. For surprisingly affordable prices and excellent choice, search online for Pacesetter Douglas. Or better still, visit the Pacesetter Bathroom and Tile Showroom on Harris Terrace and see the new styles in store.
You can get the best of everything, where the price is twice as nice.
TT 2024 is almost here, and once again Manx Radio will bring you every moment of the action with the best biking station in the world. How does this sound? Senior TT winner.
Sounds absolutely epic, doesn't it?
Practice and race commentary, interviews with all the top riders, along with the latest travel and weather updates. We'll also bring you pre-TT practice and race sessions at the Balan Circuit.
You can listen online at motorsport.manxradio.com, or smartphone app on AM 1368 and on DAB in Douglas, Onken and the Central Valley.
The best biking station in the world.
It all starts this afternoon at 5 o'clock with our pre-TT coverage getting underway from 6.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
And David Ashford, MHK. Housing and Communities Boards receive the least amount of all transfers made to government through in internal funds. £5 million to the Project Development Fund, £4.15 million to the Legal Cost Reserve, £3.5 million to the Healthcare Transformation Fund, £3 million to the Medical Indemnity Fund, £2 million to Agriculture and Forestry, £1.5 million to Contingency, £1.5 million to the Transformation Fund. Are you happy with a million?
So what we've got to be clear on with the Housing Communities Board is that the actual bulk of housing and the division of housing actually sits within DOI. So the Housing Communities Board isn't a department. The division actually sits within DOI. Our budget is actually for specialist projects, so if we need to bring in specialist support. So it's slightly different to some of the other funds. So the million actually is very welcome. But obviously, if we're going to start building things and anything else, that'll fall under the auspices of DOI and their housing division. So we just need to be clear that it's not like a departmental budget in terms of housing. It is literally what it says on the tin. It's a committee.
What will it be used for?
So there's various different things that people can apply to the Housing Communities Board fund for. So internally, for instance, one of the things we've been looking at is supported housing for those who may be suffering from homelessness or temporary loss of accommodation. The fund has been used in able to be able to try and support them and actually provide accommodation for them. So it's you, and we've used it as well to help develop the homelessness strategy. We've used it, of course, for the OHAN as well, in developing and bringing that forward. So it's things like that. But if there's any specific projects that need to be done, then that can be an application to the Housing Communities Board fund.
Texter 284, good afternoon. The housing report states 13% of all housing stock is empty. What are the plans to tackle the over 6,000 empty properties?
So I mentioned this in an interview with Manx Radio the other day. We need to be a bit careful about what we talk about empty properties or vacant properties, which is the phrase. Vacant is very different to empty, because vacant can, of course, include properties that are unoccupied for a portion of the year, a good portion of the year, but are occupied at other times and they are still maintained or still owned. The big bulk that need to be tackled is, of course, dilapidated properties and properties that abandon properties. I think there's a mix of things we can do, including incentives and disincentives, and there's a public consultation that will be going out shortly, asking the public around this, and for whether about steps that government can take. One of the things I have long supported is vacant properties in that way not getting the zero rating, that they still have to pay their rates. At the moment, as things stand, if you disconnected your water supply from a vacant property and your services, you effectively could apply to be zero rated. I don't believe that is right. The rate should continue to be charged on those properties, and so people are actually having to pay for it. And I think if you start hitting people in the pocket with that, they'll soon think about whether those properties should be maintained and should be put back in use.
But I mean, the councils do have dilapidation officers. They do have people who go around, and we all know the ones that have been empty and look like mausoleums for decades and nothing seems to get done. Everybody points at everybody else.
And that's why, again, it goes back to my local authority days, where it was a big frustration of mine on Douglas Council, is, you know, the local authorities, certainly the big local authorities, I think are trying their best with what they've got and the powers they've got. I think it comes down to a carrot and stick approach. We need to incentivise people to bring properties back to life and back into use, but also, like I say, the stick approach in terms of saying, right, well, the rates continue to be charged. We actually tighten up potentially the powers open to local authorities in terms of the speed they can turn things round and the orders that they can place on people, because the Building Control Act, I think, is 1986. So again, it's a piece of legislation that's a long time ago, and we need to revise all those powers. And like I say, there will be a public consultation around different proposals for carrot and stick approach for vacant properties that will be going out.
Okay, Brian, you're live with David Ashford.
Oh, I've just heard him talk about the carrot and stick approach. Well, what a good idea, David. Would you support a bill that enabled us or the people or government to sack senior officers whose departments go crazily over budget because of their incompetence and even take away some of their enhanced pensions? Would you support that?
I think.
Do you accept responsibility?
In terms
of, in part, for creating the housing crisis that we've got at the moment.
Okay, David.
Right, so in terms of enhanced pensions, Brian, I think you'd have a problem with anything around pensions, because pensions, depending upon what the contracts are, a legal entitlement. In terms of senior officers, they most certainly should be held to account for budgetary responsibility. I made a very long speech at budget time around the overspends in government and the fact that it can't continue, that departments need to come in on budget. I know there's been a lot of work at Treasury, but ultimately the accountable officers do need to be held for account for any overspends, and particularly on capital projects, because particularly the Liverpool landing stage and the way that went, there does need to be accountability within the civil service and accountability at political level.
Brian?
We seem to have forgotten the £400 million for a power station and all sorts of other things that have slipped through the net that you seem to have done nothing about. You might have asked the odd question, but nothing has happened, David.
Well, actually, I wasn't around when the power station one certainly was done. I've only been in Tynwald since 2016. But actually, I have been pressing. I've been bringing forward motions. I've been pressing Treasury around how the budget process is done in terms of the accountability of officers. There's been changes to the way that to the hierarchy within government. Does it go far enough? I would say potentially no. I think there's still a lot of work to be done, but it has started. And accountability is absolutely key. Departments need to be accountable for every penny they spent. When this island, and I said this at budget time, back in 2001, 2000, when the money was flowing in and everything else, maybe it didn't matter if certain things went overspent because there was the continuously increasing reserves. That is not the case now. Those reserves are precious, and if we keep spending the way we are spending, as I again pointed out at budget time, the value of the reserves, so the amount of reserve equivalent to the annual spend of government, will be at its lowest level since the 1980s by the end of this administration. And that needs to be changed, and it needs to be changed now. But we need to work collectively as politicians. One politician is not going to change the world. Tynwald needs to act collectively, and I certainly, I can assure you, will be doing my bit to hold things to account.
Okay, we're on the homeward straight, Brian. You had a question about the landlord's bill, didn't you?
The landlord's bill. Do you accept responsibility? It's nice the way you cut my microphone off so he can get his political stance in. in play. But anyway, the landlord's bill, that has pushed an awful lot of people away from being private landlords. I am a landlord. I have a number of properties. I point out to you, David, that when I receive £1,000 in rent, £200 of that goes in income tax. I also have to pay VAT on any repairs, which local authority housing doesn't. So the private landlord is disadvantaged. You've spoken about partnerships. The document I've got before me relates to empty properties. I happen to have one of those as well, and you mentioned it, and the carrot and stick approach. And I've had this empty now for 5 years. But I have paid the rates throughout that period. I've had no reductions in any form whatsoever. And there's a very good reason why, from a business point of view, I haven't been able to get onto that property. And now you're threatening, or you're proposing in this document that I have before me, compulsory purchase and doubling the rates. And even prison sentences for people who don't comply. How's that a partnership approach? That's a draconian approach that's pushing people away from renting properties.
No, I think we're at mixed purposes here, Brian. The properties I'm referring to are the ones that, you know, we all know well, where they are dilapidated properties, where they are properties that have been abandoned. If you've got a rental property that has been vacant for whatever reason, and there will be various reasons, because there may be serious amounts of work needing doing to that property internally, so there's a very valid reason why the landlord might not be able to rent it, or you may not even be able to find someone to rent it. That is not what we're talking about. We most certainly are not talking about those properties and turning around and saying, well, we'll compulsory purchase it and all the rest of it. It is very, very much on the long-term vacant properties, on the problem, what I'd refer to from a local authority point of view, is the problem properties. It is not intended to step on landlords' toes. I actually agree with your points in terms of, you know, what is actually been causing problems for some landlords in terms of accessing accessing services, interest rates, actually ensuring that they can actually make a living, because that's been something that has driven some private landlords out of the sector.
Okay, all right, thanks for that. Thank you, Brian. We're out of time. Thanks to David Ashford. Of course, we have a full switchboard, a pile of questions. So the question is, will you pop back later on this summer?
I will come back anytime you want, Andy, you know that.
Good to hear from you. Thanks for being with us today, David Ashford, and thanks also for your contributions. Good to hear from you. Thanks to Chris Quirk on the phones today. Stick around, the Prince of Wales, the King, is on the way shortly.
W-I-N-T.
W-I-N-T.
Make Sunday special with the Manxman Sunday Lunch on board the dining car, where you can enjoy a superb two-course meal and train travel. The Manxman Sunday Lunch is available on selected Sundays throughout the season, with special prices for children. So bring friends and family along as the dining car puts on its Sunday best. To book, call 697 457 or for menus, visit rail.im.
Helmets are on and engines are revving, which only means one thing. The new season of the TT races is heating up. And no matter if you're at the track or in front of the telly, Tesco can help you fuel the fun. Choose from our range of ready-made snacks and drinks, prep for a picnic with our deli selection, or get ready for a grill up in the garden. So, put the pedal to the metal and visit your local store before the action starts. Tesco, every little helps.
Riders, rev up and head to Ramsey. Enjoy a bike ride north to see the spectacular Queen's Pier in Ramsey. It's an amazing and historic landmark that the Queen's Pier Restoration Trust are striving to restore. Find out more on Facebook. And if you can spare a few pounds to help save this fantastic structure, you'll also find the Queen's Pier Restoration Trust GoFundMe link on Facebook. Don't miss a visit to the Queen's Pier this TT. This audio has been kindly sponsored by Paul Carey and Sons.
The extended Ramsey Garden Centre is deceptively large. You'll find a warm welcome and everything from bedding and perennials, fruit and vegetables, to lighting, garden ornaments, bird baths, bird tables and indoor and outdoor pots. Come and browse at Ramsey Garden Centre.
60 years serving you as the nation station. This is Manx Radio.
There are hopes that the King may be able to visit this island in the not-too-distant future. But as Prince of Wales, he was here a number of times. We rarely hear a royal speaking in public. They generally don't do interviews. So the time-honoured method is to follow behind the royal progress and, after a moment, inquire of those who have spoken to the royal personage what the conversation involved. This is what Chris Price did in Craigneish in 1996 when Prince Charles visited the island.
There were the children dancing on the green. There was a demonstration of thatching, of dry stone walling. And up on the hill just above Craigneish, two old cart horses were demonstrating the traditional way of Manx ploughing. Lots to see and lots to do. And at the Craigishy Tea Rooms, His Royal Highness was given the chance of sampling traditional Manx fare, such as Manx broth and bonnag and Manx tay. We'll find out in a moment if he did. First, as His Royal Highness went round Craigneish, I spoke to some of the children dressed in traditional costume that he'd just spoken to. Your name is?
Brishi Jennings.
And you're from Ballasalla, are you?
Yeah.
Now, you're here today all dressed up in this costume. Tell me about this costume.
Well, this dress here was, it's locked and it's real.
Yes.
And my grandma sewn this shawl for me.
And you've got some eggs in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't offer them to the prince then?
No.
I see. And you've got a bonnet on as well. This is the traditional Manx costume dating back to 19th century, is it?
Yeah.
And how old are you?
I'm 9.
And what did the prince say to you?
He was asking me about the eggs. If they were real.
Oh, really? And where did they come from?
They came
house
from
house down there, just
there.
Here at Craigneish.
Yeah.
And what's your name?
Louis Jennings.
How old are you, Louis?
I'm 8.
And what did the prince say to you?
Nothing really. Just like.
You're just standing there, were you?
Okay.
And you've got a jumper on, and you're dressed also in costume. Is this made from Lockton wool?
Yeah.
It is. And another one here with a very smart hat on, a real farmer's hat. What's your name?
Cameron Sayer.
How old are you, Cameron?
9.
And did the prince speak to you?
Yeah.
What did he say?
Just said if I liked eggs or not.
Oh, I see. You're talking mostly about the eggs the bridge is holding.
Yeah.
And tell me about this costume.
Oh, I didn't really know much about it because I didn't know much about this one.
I see. It's a typical farmer's costume, is it?
Yeah.
You've got a black waistcoat and grey trousers and boots and a striped shirt without a collar and a lovely round farmer's type hat.
Part of Island life for 60 years. This is your Manx Radio.